time before last time, remember we had talked about Matthew 14 that Pastor Brian had taught, remember they had the Pharisees had called him out and asked him why he allowed his disciples to eat with unwashed hands, and he said, it's not what goes into a man that defiles him, but what comes out of him, because from the fullness of the heart, the mouth speaks. And so if you speak evil, that's what defiles you. That was at the beginning of Matthew 15. And so when we were talking about that, we talked about the importance of, in the Gospels, when you're studying the Gospels, to look at the parallel accounts, if there are any, to take the different point of view of the same story. And as we saw that Mark had a parallel account in Mark 7, I think. And the difference between what Mark and Matthew had to say was these parenthetical explanations. Remember, Matthew didn't seem to think they were necessary, because he was speaking to Jews and they would have understood all these dietary laws. But Mark was primarily focused on speaking to Gentiles, so they might have needed a little bit of explanation. Remember all that? And then last time we went through that whirlwind tour of the Holy Land. Remember that? And I posted that up on the web so you can look at it again if you want. Look at those maps, and I recorded a little talk over on it. So continuing now in Matthew 15, remember, this is a continuation of the pattern that Matthew had established, where he would talk about Jesus teaching something, and then he would tell the stories of some miracles, and then he'd talk about Jesus teaching something and tell the stories of some miracles. So this is the miracle side of this second cycle of Matthew doing that. And remember, Matthew's focus, the purpose of his gospel, was to convince Jews that Jesus is their Mashiach, their anointed one, the promised one that had that they'd been waiting for hundreds, thousands of years. And so the reason that Matthew retells the stories of all these miracles is because he was trying to convince them that only God can do such things. And you remember when Nicodemus came to Jesus, and this is in John 3, in verse 2, he said, Rabbi, we know that you're a teacher come from God, for no one can do these signs that you do unless God is with him. And now, unfortunately, Nicodemus stopped short of saying, you are God. We don't know whether he eventually came to believe that or not, possibly. But Matthew was in agreement with what Jesus said to Philip. Remember, Philip, on the night that he was betrayed, Philip had said, you know, show us the Father and it'll be enough for us. And then Jesus said this in John 14:10, do you not believe that I am in the Father and the Father is in me? The words that I say to you, I do not speak on my own authority, but the Father who dwells in me does his works. Believe me that I am in the Father and the Father is in me, or else believe on account of the works themselves. All right? So that's why Matthew is recounting these stories of miracles, because only God can do them. And yet, early on in his ministry, remember, over and over and over, Jesus said, no, don't tell anybody about this, right? Keep this to yourself. Of course, nobody did, right? But, you know, why did Jesus do that? Remember when they asked for him to show them a sign to prove that he was who he said he was, he said, and this is in Matthew 12, verse 39, he says, an evil and adulterous generation seeks for a sign, but no sign will be given to it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. For just as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of the great fish, so will the Son of Man be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. He never did any miracles to put on a show. He never did any miracles to prove something to somebody. right? Most often when he healed somebody, he said, your faith has healed you. Or in one case, he said, your faith has saved you. So his miracles were a response to people's faith, not a desire to cause people to have faith because of the miracles, right? Right. And the other thing about that is he knew. He knew that, it, you know, if you've already made up your mind, right, you'll find a way to explain away these things. We do it all the time, don't we? My favorite example of that is the parting of the Red Sea. People will tell you, and you can find, you know, all you have to do is Google, you know, Red Sea pedestrian or something. And you'll, oh, no, it wasn't the Red Sea. That was the Sea of Reeds, you know. And the wind regularly blows that thing dry. They just walked. It was just a big wind, right? Well, big winds come from God anyway, but we'll ignore that. And then, of course, that doesn't explain how that shallow little sea then turned around and absorbed the whole Egyptian army, right? But, you know, we find these explanations for these miracles, and we do it ourselves. At least I do. I don't know about you. Jesus knew that doing miracles wouldn't draw people to faith. We'd find a way to explain it away. And he said, this is in John 6:44, no one can come to me unless the Father who has sent me draws him. I will raise him up at the last day. So with those principles understood, let's go ahead and launch into this next section in verse 21 of Matthew 15. It says, and Jesus went away from there and withdrew to the district of Tyre and Sidon. And behold, a Canaanite woman from that region came out and was crying, have mercy on me, O Lord, son of David. My daughter is severely oppressed by a demon. But he did not answer her a word, and his disciples came and begged him, saying, send her away, for she's crying out after us. He answered, I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. But she came and knelt before him, saying, Lord, help me. And he answered, it's not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. She said, yes, Lord, yet even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from their master's table. Then Jesus answered her, O woman, great is your faith. Be it done for you as you desire. And her daughter was healed instantly. And as I said, it's always helpful to look at the parallel accounts. Mark gives us a pretty similar account. He says, and this is in Mark 7, starting in verse 24. It says, and from there he arose and went away to the region of Tyre and Sidon, and he entered a house and did not want anyone to know, yet he could not be hidden. But immediately a woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit heard of him and came and fell down at his feet. Now the woman was a Gentile, a Syrophoenician by birth, and she begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter, and he said to her, let the children be fed first, for it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. But she answered him, yes, Lord, yet even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs. And he said to her, for this statement you may go your way, the demon has left your daughter. And she went home and found the child lying in bed and the demon gone. So just as an aside here, we have four Gospels. And God gave us four Gospels for specific reasons. If you talk to any cop, they'll tell you eyewitness accounts are incredibly unreliable. You know, what we used to say in the beekeeping club was if you ask three beekeepers a question, you'll get five different answers. But the reason God gave us four Gospels is so that we would each have a slightly different point of view that would ring a chord, that would strike a chord with various people. God knew that these were going to go out into the world and people were going to read them and they were going to consider them and consider if Jesus is God like he says he is. They would consider whether he really is resurrected. And so he gave us four accounts to have different points of view. And I like to compare it to, you know, people say that these aren't really four accounts, that Matthew copied from Mark, and right? And it brought to my mind, you know, a teacher grading a test. And he got two students that have the same answer, right? Now, if both of those answers are wrong, the chances, and if they sit next to each other, chances are pretty good when I'm copied off the other. But if they're both right, then the chances are at least better that they both came up with the right answer on their own, right? And, you know, of course, God's answers are always right. So God gave these guys, by his Spirit, the motivation, the unction to write the Gospels using their own, I hate to say preconception, but their own baggage, their own past histories that they brought with them. And also using their own desire to speak to different people. Does that make sense? So that's why we have four of them, and they're slightly different. Anyway, so moving on here, well, starting again, it says, and Jesus went away from there and withdrew the district of Tyre. Now, it isn't completely clear where Jesus came from. If we were to take these accounts as being chronological, then in Matthew 14, it says that after the feeding of the 5,000, Jesus had gone back across the sea and landed at a place called Gennesaret. We saw that. It's that flat plain area between Magdala, where Mary Magdalene was from, and Capernaum. So he may have been coming from there if these guys are strictly chronological. Regardless of that, we know where he went. Tyre and Sidon are in the southeast of Lebanon, or southwest of Lebanon. They're on the seacoast. They were Phoenician seaports of at one time, they'd been very powerful, and they were populated mostly by Gentiles. There were probably some Jews living there, but mostly by Gentiles. And so that kind of begs the question, why did he go there? Because he said, remember, I've come to the lost sheep of Israel. So possibly he went to Tyre and Sidon to minister to some Jewish person or people. I don't think so, though. I think he went to Tyre and Sidon specifically to minister to this woman, this Gentile woman. And he'd done this before. He went down from the northwest corner of the sea down to the southeast corner of the sea to the land of the Gadarenes. Gadara is one of the Decapolis. And he healed that guy there that had been possessed by the legion of demons. Well, that guy was a Gentile, for sure, right? How do we know? What'd he do with the demons? Put them into a herd of pigs, right? Well, Jews wouldn't have had no pigs. They don't eat pig, right? Pity on them. But he...
My whole life, I've tried to figure out. My granddaddy would eat pork, but he would not touch beef.
Interesting.
I never got around to asking him because he's long gone now. Yep. But I was wondering if it had something to do with old time religion or what.
Unless he was a Hindu. Hindus don't eat beef, right? Because they consider cows to be sacred. But I doubt if he was. But anyway, Jews don't eat pork. That's in I got a note of it somewhere. I think it's later on.
That means he was a Gentile.
Well, these guys were raising pigs, right? Jews don't raise pigs. So obviously those guys were Gentiles. And what's interesting about that is he went across there, healed the guy, went right back across. Right? He went there specifically for that reason. There's another example in, she wasn't a Gentile, but she was a Samaritan, right? In John 4, is it John? I think it's John 4. It says that he had to pass through Samaria. Well, he didn't have to pass through Samaria. Matter of fact, Samaria was the hard way. Normally, when people went to Jerusalem from Galilee, they would go along the Jordan, go up at Jericho, up the hill to Jerusalem, because you didn't have to go up and down and up and down and up and down through the wilderness. And there was water right there. Up in the mountains up in Samaria, there ain't no water at all. So that's why people would, when they made the pilgrimages, you know, they had to go to those three feasts every year. They would always go down through the Jordan Valley and then up to Jerusalem. Anyway, he didn't have to pass through Samaria. He passed through Samaria because he knew he had a rendezvous with destiny with this woman at the well. So I think he made this trip specifically to minister to this particular woman. Now, Mark tells us that he went hoping that he wouldn't be discovered. Well, he was discovered regardless of that. You know, Jesus is God, but in the flesh of Jesus of Nazareth, he was subject to the same sort of things that we are. He hungered, he thirsted, he needed to sleep. So maybe he just wanted to spend time alone with his father. He did that a lot. But whatever reason he went there, this woman came to him and says, "And behold, a Canaanite woman from that region came out and was crying, 'Have mercy on me, O Lord, Son of David.'" Now, Matthew says that this woman was a Canaanite. The word Canaanite just means a resident of Canaan, which is that area. And it includes all those ites that Joshua conquered and the ones that he didn't conquer, right? But by the time of Jesus, this word Canaanite had come to mean Phoenician, right? Specifically a Phoenician. Now Mark tells us that this woman was of mixed Syrian and Phoenician descent, right? So remember, Syria is just to the east of there. And anyway, what's important here isn't her identity, but what she says. And that's why Matthew points it out. He says, "Lord," or she says, "Lord, Son of David." Now remember, Matthew's trying to convince Jews that Jesus is the Messiah, right? The Son of David. And so Matthew points that out. Mark doesn't, which I thought was pretty interesting. Now, I want to take a little bit of time with this one and how are we doing here, because I probably ain't going to make it through all of 15 tonight. I'll just keep that right there. He says, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, but she came and knelt before him saying, 'Lord, help me.' And he answered, 'It's not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs.'" I find this kind of disturbing, really, to be perfectly honest, and unsavory. But I think I maybe understand it a little bit. And he says it's not right to throw the children's bread to the dog. Now, Jews would have understood what he was talking about, right? Because they call Gentiles dogs and vice versa, right? Mark says something even more cryptic in verse 27 of Mark 7. He says, "Let the children be fed first, for it's not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." Now, I'm not sure a Gentile would have got what Mark was trying to say there, right? But anyway, both groups called each other other gods. Dogs. I got an interesting story about that. You know, in Hawaii, they have this goddess called Pele, the volcano goddess. And they leave out food and rum for her. Apparently, Pele likes rum. And they leave out these little buffets for Pele. And we were up there at Kilauea, when was that? I don't know, 2006, I think it was. And one of the ladies we were with says, "It's an offering to the dogs." Yeah, actually it was. So Jesus came proclaiming the kingdom of God to Jews. And it was important that it be that way because it was a fulfillment of prophecy, remember? Specifically the prophecy that God gave to Abraham in Genesis 22, verse 18. He says, "In your seed," that is in your offspring, "all the nations of the earth shall be blessed because you have obeyed my voice." This was after Abraham had shown his willingness to sacrifice Isaac. Jesus was a Jew. He came to Jews, and it was important that that be that way because it was a fulfillment of the prophecy that God had given for all mankind, but specifically to Abraham. But Jesus said later, come to me all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. So he didn't come just for Jews. Now, why did he say it's not right to offer this gospel to the gods or to the dogs? I really find that kind of distasteful. I think he did it so that she would have the chance to react in the way that she did. Because she said, yeah, but even the dogs get to eat. All right. And of course, he responded to her faith in that way. Now, I want to stop and fall back just for a minute here. You guys know my soapboxes by now. We need to be careful of extending this. Okay, your faith has healed your daughter, right? There are unscrupulous men and women today who have stood in pulpits this Sunday morning and proclaimed that if you have enough faith, God will give you exactly what you want, right? This is that prosperity gospel. And I read some horrible statistics a few weeks ago that apparently upwards of 60, something like 70% of Christians in America are buying into this prosperity gospel today. Prosperity preaching churches are the largest, fastest growing churches in America, have been for years. Why is that a problem? Because it shipwrecks people's faith. They come in faith, they sow into these people's ministries, and they don't get what they want, and they turn around and walk the other way, and they may never hear the real gospel. That's the tragedy of it, and that's why I'm... Yeah. And it breaks my heart. So that's why I'm so adamant about it. But this woman had a specific, genuine, dire need. It wasn't, she didn't want a Mercedes Benz. She didn't ask anything for herself. She asked for her daughter to be healed, right? And Jesus responded to her faith in that way.
She knew where to go, too.
Yep, yeah. And she knew who he was, Son of David. So, continuing on here in verse 29, it says, Jesus went out from there and walked beside the Sea of Galilee, and he went up on the mountain and sat down there, and great crowds came to him, bringing with them the lame, the blind, the crippled, the mute, and many others, and they put them at his feet, and he healed them, so that the crowd wondered when they saw the mute speaking, the crippled healthy, the lame walking, and the blind seeing, and they glorified the God of Israel. Now, this reminds me, this isn't in my notes, but it just reminded me, what did Jesus say to those guys that came from John the Baptist? Remember, John the Baptist had said, are you the one that we've been waiting for, or should we look for another? And he said, go tell John that the lame walk, the blind see, and the poor have the good news preached to them, right? The dead are raised, he said, right? So that's what this reminded me of. He healed all these people.
We don't know the number of miracles.
Yep. Oh, yeah. Well, I think John, and I think maybe Matthew too, say that if all the miracles have been written, you couldn't write them in all the books in all the world, right? Anyway, the parallel passage in Mark gives us a few additional details here, if I can only get my page. It's in Mark 7, verse 31. It says, and then he returned from the region of Tyre and went through Sidon to the Sea of Galilee in the region of the Decapolis. And they brought to him a man who was deaf and had a speech impediment, and they begged him to lay his hands on him. And taking him aside from the crowd privately, he put his fingers in his ears and after spitting, touched his tongue. And looking up to heaven, he sighed and said to him, Ephphatha, that is, be opened. And his ears were opened, his tongue was released, and he spoke plainly. And Jesus charged them to tell no one. But the more he charged them, the more zealously they proclaimed it. And they were astonished beyond measure, saying, he has done all things well. He even makes the deaf hear and the mute speak. Now, Mark says that he did this in Decapolis. You remember Decapolis was on the other side of the Sea of Galilee from Tyre and Sidon. But what's interesting is I'll get to that in a minute. But remember, if you look at that map that I had where it said the travels of Jesus and there are all these lines, and remember I said, be careful about these lines, because those lines on that map assume that all these things happen in chronological order. They didn't necessarily go that way. If we read these things as if they were step by step, day by day, then he went from feeding the 5,000 back to Gennesaret, up by Mary Magdalene's home, then over to Tyre and Sidon, then back down to Decapolis, right, to do this healing. Well, that may or may not be. We already talked about Legion. What is important here, I think, in what Matthew says, is at the very end of this. And they've glorified the God of Israel. Now, if you read that in the Greek, that's not the name of God like Elohim or Adonai or any of those other names that the Jews called God by. He says, the God of Israel. And that, to me, is kind of a evidence that this did happen down in the Decapolis, which was mostly Gentile. Right, we saw because of Legion and the pigs. And by the way, I said I'd have that reference, and that reference is Leviticus 11:7. It says, you'll not eat any animals that have cloven hooves, but don't chew the cud. And the pigs have the split hooves, but they don't chew the cud. So anyway, that's why they didn't eat pigs. It's possible, maybe even probable, that this deaf guy was a Gentile. And the reason I think that is because of what Matthew says here. He doesn't use the name of God. He says the God of Israel, right? And so what I think he's implying but not saying explicitly is he's speaking to Jews, remember? And he says, these guys, basically what he was saying, see, these guys get it. This is the Mashiach, right? Even the Gentiles understand that, see? That's the reason I think that this happened in the Decapolis. It's interesting here that in Mark it says that Jesus sighed. Matthew doesn't say that. And that kind of tells me, you know, Matthew was for sure an eyewitness, right? Jesus called him from the text office, right? Said, come with me, and he dropped everything and went, right? He said, follow me, right? So we know Matthew saw all these things. We know John saw all these things because he called him and said, I'll make you fishers of men, right? He saw all of the, John and Matthew for sure saw all these events. We know that Luke did not. Luke did not become a believer until later on during Paul's missionary journeys. But we don't really know about Mark. Jesus, by this time, had hundreds of disciples, many more than the 12 we normally think of. He had hundreds, maybe even thousands, following him. Go to the Palm Sunday. You know, there were thousands of people. Hosanna. Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. So he had a lot of followers. Maybe Mark was one of them. And the reason this kind of gives me a clue is that he said that Jesus sighed. Well, that kind of impresses me with either he saw it or whoever told him the story later on, it impressed them so much that Jesus sighed that he included that detail. But who knows, really? And then, where are we at here? I think we're doing good. Yeah, we got time. In verse 32, it says, then Jesus called his disciples to him and said, I have compassion on the crowd because they've been with me now 3 days and have nothing to eat, and I am unwilling to send them away hungry, lest they faint on the way. And the disciples said to him, where are we to get enough bread in such a desolate place to feed so great a crowd? And Jesus said to them, how many loaves do you have? They said, 7, and a few small fish. And directing the crowd to sit down on the ground, he took... It wasn't me talking, baby. It was a key lime pie talking. directed the crowd to sit down on the ground. He took the 7 loaves and the fish. Having given thanks, he broke them and gave them to the disciples. And the disciples gave them to the crowds, and they all ate and were satisfied. And they took up 7 baskets full of the broken pieces left over. Those who ate were 4,000 men, besides women and children. And after sending away the crowds, he got into the boat and went to the region of Magadan. Now, you may remember Magadan is another name for Magdala, Mary Magdalene's home. So this may have happened in the Decapolis, right? If all these things happen in order, then this may have happened in the Decapolis. And if it did, then this was a mixed crowd of Jews and Gentiles. And that in itself is kind of intriguing, because Jews didn't eat with Gentiles, and Gentiles didn't eat with Jews. Now, by the way, to my knowledge, and y'all can correct me if I'm wrong, there's nothing in the Bible, in the Old Testament, that directs Jews not to eat with Gentiles. I don't think there is. But there's, by the time of Jesus' ministry, this had grown up into a tradition that was put out by the elders, and they were told to follow it.
I relate that to the segregation growing up.
Yep.
The kids, you know, matter of fact.
It's what they're taught.
If we went to Cecil Creek to go swimming, if there was blacks in there, we didn't swim. We were afraid they would wash off and make us black.
Well, I'm telling you.
How stupid we were.
I can tell you this, that water is black.
Oh, yeah. And it's cold, too.
comes out of a spring up there in Minetta.
Same creek, I lost 2 front teeth.
Oh. Diving where you shouldn't?
Right.
Yep.
I dived where it was too shallow.
Yep. Well, you know who Johnny Erickson Tata is. She lost the use of her legs, and she almost lost her life from a broken neck, from diving where she shouldn't. She didn't know what she was diving into. She dived into a rock. Anyway, we don't know if this happened chronologically or not. Matthew just says, then, right? And Mark's even vaguer. He says, in those days, right? But this may or may not have been a mixed crowd of Gentiles and Jews. And if it was, this tradition was custom made for Jesus. He loved to flaunt these traditions. Right.
Well, you know, it just about had to be a mixed congregation.
Yeah.
You want to call it at that time. At that point, because he'd done.
Oh, yeah.
Made himself known, and the followers, the people who believed in him, it didn't matter if they at that time, didn't matter if they were Jews or Gentiles.
Especially after they got that free meal with the 5,000, right?
Yeah.
That statement. Growing up, of course, the blacks and the whites were separate. And when I got to Vietnam, we was all together.
Mm-hmm.
And all the blood.
Real eye-opener.
Now, some of the higher-ups treated them different.
Mm-hmm.
But we were all brothers. I can tell you that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you had to rely on each other.
It
didn't really matter who the guy next to you was, as long as he could shoot straight and warn you about stuff that was happening.
When the state park started, it was a county park. Racist was the manager up there. And when they segregated, he left. He said he wasn't going to be there. They were going to have blacks and whites in the same colony.
When we signed our papers for this house up here, the very first thing I asked Tana, is there a CC&R? No, there's no CC&R. Covenants, codes, and restrictions, right? Very well, let's proceed. We get to the closing. Sign this CC&R, please. So I thought you told me there was no CC&R. Well, it's just one sheet. And on the sheet it said, no members of the colored race shall own property on Lake Becky or be residents on Lake Becky, except as domestic servants. And I showed that to the lawyer. I said, you know this is completely illegal and unenforceable.
Yeah.
She said, yeah, I know. So we signed it because it doesn't commit me to anything. Yeah, it was made in 1958. And
well, 1958 is about when they closed the Estill Beach State Park because of segregation.
Yeah, I can see Homer and the rest of them being that way.
Yeah.
Anyway, to my knowledge, like I said, there was nothing in the law forbidding Jews and Gentiles to eat together. And this was just the kind of thing that Jesus liked to rub their face in it. You know, see this tradition of yours, it's silly and it's wrong. Anyway, but what's more important to my way of thinking is the way that he did this feeding. And it says, let's see. And having given thanks, he broke the bread and gave them to the disciples. And I went looking, and there are a few different places where it talks about Jesus and bread, and they're all virtually identical. One of them was the feeding of the 5,000 that we just looked at in, what was it, Matthew 14. He gave thanks, broke the bread, gave it to somebody else before eating it himself, right? This one here, gave thanks. And by the way, I've got in my notes, I've got references and the cross references. You can look up where all these things were. This one here, gave thanks, broke the bread, gave it to somebody else. Presumably he ate himself later. I don't know. It doesn't say so. And then on the night he was betrayed, in the upper room, he compared his body to bread, remember? He said, well, this was earlier on in John. It says, I am the living bread. This is John 6:51. I'm the living bread that came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever. And the bread that I will give for the life of the world is my flesh. So he had predicted this earlier on in Jerusalem. And then on that night, he gave thanks, broke the bread, and said, take this. This is my body, given for many, which is given for you, is what Luke says. And then the one that struck me was on the day that the empty tomb was discovered, right? Later that afternoon, there were two disciples going from Jerusalem to Emmaus, remember? And that's in Luke 24. Starting in verse 13, and he spent the whole day with them, right? And they didn't recognize him. He was reasoning from the scriptures how these things that they had just witnessed in Jerusalem had been predicted, remember? And he was with them all day, and then when they got to where they were going to stay for the night, he was made like he was going to go on, but they said, no, come stay with us. And so he came in, and this is what happened. It says, this is in Luke 24, verse 30. When he was at the table with them, he took the bread, blessed and broke it, and gave it to them. And their eyes were opened, and they recognized him, and he vanished from their sight. They said to each other, did not our hearts burn within us while he talked to us on the road, while he opened us to us the scriptures? And they rose that same hour and returned to Jerusalem. Now, they wouldn't have got back to Jerusalem until early in the morning, but, you know, 7 miles from Emmaus to Jerusalem. And they rose that same hour and returned to Jerusalem, and they found the 11 and those who were with them gathered together, saying, the Lord is risen indeed and has appeared to Simon. They had told these guys coming back that. Then they told what happened on the road and how he was known to them in the breaking of the bread. Now, just in closing here, remember in the story of the feeding of the 5,000, they gathered up 12 baskets, right? One for each of the apostles. Right? In this one, they gather up 7, and I'm not really sure I understand the significance of that, except that 7 in the Bible always represents perfection or completeness. But apart from that, I really can't say the significance of that 7. Now, before we close, remember it says that Matthew says that they returned to the region of Magadan, which would have been on the other side of the lake from Decapolis, if this happened in Decapolis. That was the home of Magdala, of Mary Magdalene, also called Magdala. And it's located, you remember that picture on that mountain that I had? We're looking down, it's like 1,200 feet. Magdala is that little village just down on the left there. And then further on, just a little bit further on, just a couple, not even a mile maybe, is this, or was, this ancient town called Dalmanutha. And if you read this account in Mark, at the end of Mark, in Mark 18, or Mark 8:10, it says that they went back to Dalmanutha. Well, you know, Magdala and Dalmanutha is a suburb of Magdala.